7 in 10 full-time workers would consider switching jobs for better benefits. Benefit strategies are crucial to building a competitive advantage. But how can employers meet diverse priorities across industries and demographics? Benefits 2.0 from Economist Impact, supported by Nuveen, a TIAA company, explores how benefits empower individuals, elevate companies, and drive the U.S. economy. Search Economist Impact Benefits 2.0 to learn more. Sponsored by Nuveen, a TIAA company.
The Economist.
Hello, and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm your host, Ore Ogunbiyi. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world. In India, voting has kicked off in the largest election of the year. Although it will take weeks for us to know for certain, Narendra Modi's ruling party is likely to win again. Why has the opposition fallen so badly behind? And a tribute to the first ever non-Japanese Yokozuna, or Grand Champion, of sumo wrestling. He was called Akebono, and for good reason. But first, for days, world leaders had been urging Israel to show restraint after Iran launched a massive but ineffective drone and missile strike on the country last weekend. The UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, warned of the dangers the region faced.
One mistake could lead to the unthinkable, a full-scale regional conflict that would be devastating for all involved and for the rest of the world.
And the British Foreign Secretary, David Cameron, urged restraint too.
Any response should be smart and that should be designed in a way that is going to limit and try to de-escalate this conflict.
President Biden says America's support for Israel is ironclad. But he also told the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, that they would not take part in retaliation against Iran. Israel, in turn, said that it would make its own decisions and vowed to retaliate anyway. And overnight, it seems that they have. Videos posted online by the BBC appeared to show flashes and explosions in an area near Isfahan city in central Iran. So does this latest strike mark the beginning of that escalation?
Israel seems to have conducted a limited response to last weekend's Iranian barrage of missiles and drones.
Greg Karlstrom is The Economist's Middle East correspondent.
There's been no official confirmation of this from Israel, but unofficially, sources there saying they did carry out a symbolic strike. And according to American officials speaking to various American media outlets, they say an Israeli missile has struck inside of Iran.
So what do we know so far?
The details are still quite limited at this point. We know that Iran has activated air defense systems near a military base in the city of Isfahan. It's a major city in central Iran. We also know that they suspended flights earlier this morning over several big cities, including Isfahan and Tehran, the capital, although they have since reopened their airspace. There were some reports in Iranian state media of explosions in and around Isfahan, but there were some Iranian media reports said the cause of those blasts were unclear, others saying that was the sound of Iranian air defenses being activated and not anything striking targets inside of Iran. That's about all we know at this point. It's still quite fragmentary. We also know that oil markets are not happy about the news and prices have spiked as a result.
Where is Isfahan and why would Israel be targeting it for an attack?
It's in central Iran, and it has several targets that Israel might have seen as significant. It's home to a major military base, an air base, where Iran has long hosted its most advanced fighter jets. These are F-14 fighter jets. They're almost half a century old at this point, so they're not advanced. But for Iran, which has been under sanctions and arms embargoes for decades. They're the most advanced fighter jets in its arsenal. It's also home to a factory that produces ballistic missiles, a major hub for producing ballistic missiles. And so if that is what Israel chose to strike, there's a certain symmetry here. Iran carried out its own retaliatory attack last weekend using ballistic missiles that would have been perhaps developed in Isfahan. And it fired those missiles at, among other targets in Israel, an airbase in Nevatim, where Israel hosts its F-35 fighter jets, its most advanced fighter jets. So what Israel seems to have struck inside of Iran is directly linked to Iran's strike in Israel this past weekend. There are also nuclear facilities in Isfahan where Iran has done some work around uranium enrichment. It's not by any means the most important hub, though, of Iranian's nuclear program. And despite some rumors earlier this morning that there had been attacks on Iran's nuclear sites, there's no evidence that that actually happened. It seems those rumors may have been incorrect.
What's Iran said in response?
So far, it is really trying to downplay the scale of this apparent Israeli attack. It has denied that there were any missiles fired at its territory. As far as the reported drones in Isfahan, both Iranian media and social media accounts linked to the Revolutionary Guard are saying that there were three small quadcopter drones that flew near this airbase in Isfahan and were shot down. And they've been circulating what look like some stock photos of very, very tiny quadcopter drones. So really trying to make it out to be like this attack was small and insignificant. And they've compared it to the scale of their own attack on Israel this past weekend, which utilized more than 300 missiles and drones. And so the rhetoric, the line in Iranian media is that we carried out a big fire and fury show against the Israelis, and all that they've been able to do is launch a few paltry quadcopter drones at us.
Greg, if this is indeed Israel's response to that massive attack by Iran involving 300 drones and missiles last weekend, it seems a bit muted. Is this Israel maybe showing restraint as it was asked to?
If this is the extent of the Israeli response, then yes, it is them showing restraint and them giving the Iranians an off-ramp to avoid further escalation here. The Israelis were considering a menu of possible retaliatory options in Iran. They could have carried out, of course, a much bigger strike, something akin to what the Iranians did last weekend, firing hundreds of missiles and drones at various targets. That almost certainly would have prompted another Iranian response, and we would have been in this escalatory cycle. At the other end of the spectrum, the Israelis had talked about covert action, cyber attacks against critical infrastructure in Iran, things of that nature. But those sorts of things, because they're by their nature covert and not public, they were seen in Israel as not being commensurate to what the Iranians did this past weekend. So if this is what they settled on, this sort of direct but symbolic attack, it shows on the one hand that they are able to strike inside of Iran and they are not deterred from striking inside of Iran. But on the other hand, because it was quite small, it gives the opportunity to the Iranians to downplay it and not respond to it. And we can at least in the short term, hopefully, avoid any further escalation.
And in terms of the danger of this tit-for-tat escalating into a much bigger conflict, where does the region stand right now?
That danger is still there, even if, for now, we avoid that much bigger conflict. We're in a new era now, where Iran, for the first time, has carried out a direct attack on Israel, and Israel has retaliated, it seems, for that attack. If we're in a period now where that sort of overt state-on-state violence is normalized in the region, then even if we avoid any sort of major escalation now, there remains a very, very high risk that we will have one in the future.
Greg, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Seven in 10 full-time workers would consider switching jobs for better benefits. Benefit strategies are crucial to building a competitive advantage. But how can employers meet diverse priorities across industries and demographics? Benefits 2.0 from Economist Impact
supported by Nuveen, a TIAA company, explores how benefits empower individuals, elevate companies, and drive the U.S. economy. Search Economist Impact Benefits 2.0 to learn more. Sponsored by Nuveen, a TIAA company.
There was some excitement in southern Chennai in India today. The actor, Rajinikanth, who is nothing short of a megastar, was among the first to cast his vote in the country's parliamentary election. He is one of almost a billion people who will have the opportunity to take part in the biggest exercise in democracy in the world. Though the vote will take weeks, many believe that the contest is already won. Narendra Modi, India's Prime Minister, is chasing a record-equalling third straight term. His BJP party is dominating in the polls, leaving its main opposition, the Congress Party, in a distant second. But it wasn't always this way. In fact, for decades, Congress, led by successive generations of Gandhis, seemed like the only game in town. So why has Congress fallen so badly behind? And what might that mean for Indian democracy?
So the Congress Party is bracing for its third straight general election defeat.
Jeremy Page is our Asia diplomatic editor.
And that will pose some really tough questions, in particular for Rahul Gandhi, its most prominent campaigner and the presumed heir to its leadership. But there may be a route back to national power for the party.
Why is the Congress Party in such a tough position?
Well, one major reason is government pressure, of course. Though Mr. Modi, the Prime Minister, would deny it, he has, to a large extent, suppressed most sources of political dissent. He's curbed the independence of the media, the judiciary, and the civil society. His investigative agencies have targeted dozens of the opposition's politicians, including Mr. Gandhi himself, by the way, and they've recently arrested two opposition party leaders. But there are, I think, three other issues which are of the Congress Party's own making. The first is ideological. Congress has really struggled to compete with the BJP's blend of Hindu nationalism and development. The second big problem is organisational, and I think the third challenge is more personal. It's to do with Rahul Gandhi's own leadership qualities and his position in the party.
Okay, let's start with the first. Why is Congress failing to get its ideological message across?
This has been a real challenge for Congress over the last decade. It's toyed around with a few things. Recently, it's made inequality very much the central theme of its campaign, promises for things like cash transfers to poor families, a minimum wage of 400 rupees a day. And I think the strategy behind it is that the party's trying to mobilize particularly lower caste minority groups, which account for about 80% of all Indians, as a way to sort of counter the BJP's own brand of majoritarian politics, which focuses on the Hindu majority, which is also around 80% of the population. But there are a few problems with this approach. One is that it's a slightly awkward message coming from a product of wealth and privilege like Mr. Gandhi. Mr. Modi, by contrast, is the son of a tea seller from relatively low caste. Another problem is that the BJP has also put welfare handouts at the centre of its own campaign, and because it controls the central government, it has more resources to dedicate to those, and it gets to put Mr. Modi's sort of face and name to a lot of them. Opinion polling suggests that many people who do like some of Congress's proposals and its manifesto, they actually trust the BJP more to deliver on its promises. So I think the risk overall is that Congress isn't going to win over enough of those votes from lower caste and minority groups. And at the same time, with some of its more divisive rhetoric, it's going to alienate, I think, a lot of the business community and the middle class.
And now let's move on to its organisational problems.
Right. So the BJP is a ruthlessly efficient machine when it comes to party management and messaging. And by contrast, Congress is slow and opaque, sometimes erratic in its decision-making. It's often been reluctant in the past to remove candidates who are loyal to the Gandhi family, even after they've lost in elections. It still relies quite heavily on those who finance their own campaigns. And its cadres, party members and officials, who it relies on to spread its message and mobilize voters on election day, they are, to a large extent, pretty disorganized and demoralized. Another problem is that Congress's message discipline is pretty sloppy. You often see public disagreements between senior Congress figures, or you have Congress figures saying things in public which upsets their alliance partners. And I think that all speaks to a broader problem of leadership.
And on the topic of leadership, what are the issues with Rahul Gandhi and his leadership qualities?
Rahul Gandhi was the party leader from 2017 to 2019. He resigned after the last general election that Congress lost, when he indeed lost his own parliament seat in a family stronghold. But he's still the most prominent campaigner in the Congress party, and he is considered still the future leader of the party. He's very much the face of it. So he's in this slightly ambiguous position where he is in some ways still the leader of the party, but he's not in fact the leader of the party. There are a few other things that have come out in my interviews with people inside Congress. Apparently, he really dislikes the kind of deal-making that's needed to manage his party and its alliances. He much prefers to focus on sort of deep discussions on political issues. He also lacks administrative experience. He has never actually run an Indian state. He's never been a chief minister, and he's never run a ministry. And I think a sort of bigger concern for the party is that he might lack the sort of ruthless streak that's needed to really grasp control of the party.
You've painted a rather dire picture here for India's main opposition party, but you did say that there might be a way back to power. How might that happen?
Well, despite all these problems, the party is still the only national alternative to the BJP. Its national vote share has been in steady decline really since the 1980s, but it retains this hard core of support amongst secular-minded Indians, amongst Muslims, other minorities, and it's still pretty popular in South India, which is the engine of India's economic growth. And I think it's also fair to say that Mr. Gandhi himself has matured as a politician. He's performed well on the campaign trail. Over the last few months, he did this mammoth two-stage journey across India, the first part of which he did largely on foot, over thousands and thousands of miles. And I went to join him in the sort of final stages of that and saw him at several rallies in Western India. And you know, compared to when I last covered an Indian election in 2009, when I also followed him on the campaign trail, he was a pretty poor speaker back then. This time around, he really looks more at ease in front of a big crowd. And the hope amongst his supporters in the party is that he can use those qualities to revitalize the party over the next 5 years, boost the morale of those party workers down at the grassroots level, and then pose a more serious challenge to the BJP, Mr. Modi, in 2029 for the next general election. And by then, Congress insiders hope public anger over things like unemployment and inequality may have started to dent Mr. Modi's popularity. And Mr. Gandhi does arguably have time on his side. He is only 53, so he's two decades younger than Mr. Modi.
But if the tide doesn't change, if Congress does keep sliding, what might that mean for India's democracy?
Well, democracies can only function well with an opposition. And it's fair to assume that we will see more democratic backsliding over the coming years if the opposition can't moderate Mr. Modi's more authoritarian tendencies. Having said that, India's democracy has survived some big tests in the past. And I think there are two reasons to be optimistic about Indian democracy. One is that it still functions pretty well at the state level. BJP only controls about half of all Indian states. Congress still controls three. And the other issue is that the BJP has really struggled to make inroads in South India. But if Congress can't reverse this long-term decline, then I think it will ultimately be replaced as the second biggest national party. And I think the other consequence is that there will be increasing calls for the Gandhi family to step aside.
Jeremy, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Ake Bono was quite a sight to watch at his wrestling contests.
Anne Rowe is The Economist's obituaries editor.
You could watch him pacing from his corner to the centre of the ring, squatting and fixing his opponent with a stare, a really fierce, focused stare that he could preserve for weeks when he was in the zone of fighting many such contests. He would be offered power water by another wrestler, and then power paper. He'd rinse his mouth with the power water, then rub his body down with the power paper, both designed to give him great strength in the ring. And all this ritual then led up suddenly to him lunging forward, charging, seizing his opponent by the throat and throwing him off the stage. It was all over, usually in seconds or so, and what it consisted of was sheer brute force. He absolutely dominated his opponents. He was just over 2 meters tall, and he weighed 235 kilos by the time he reached the end of his career. So he was a mountain of a man. And as you watched him, glistening with sweat and naked except for a loincloth, his hair tied up in an elaborate top knot, he was really quite a terrifying spectacle. Most of his advantage came from his height. His name, Ake Bono, meant dawn because when he stood up, he reminded people of the sun rising. But a lot of it, too, came from the fact that he was a foreigner. He'd simply been born big. He was a Hawaiian, and he had been, in boyhood, a pretty good basketball player. And so he was spotted by a sumo recruiter and went to Japan at the age of 18 to learn to be a sumo wrestler. This was pretty rare in those days. It was 1988 when he went. There were very, very few foreigners accepted to be sumo wrestlers, very few who could take the training. His name, when he was born, was Chad Rowan. He was the son of a half-Irish, half-Hawaiian taxi driver. But then he suddenly found himself in Japan, without being able to speak a word of Japanese, pining for American food, and yet sent almost immediately to a sumo training camp, or a stable as they're known. And there life was very different indeed. In fact, he said he had to unlearn all the codes of life that he'd grown up with. He also had to put up with some terribly cold winters, and still the fact that he couldn't really say much to his colleagues in the stable. But like them, he had to go through a punishing regime of getting up at 4 a.m. to do exercises. And as well, the importance of being absolutely obedient to your superiors and indeed subservient to them, cleaning up after them, helping them run errands, cooking the rice for them, feeding them before you got any rice yourself. He did, in fact, extremely well with all this work and sailed through the 15 annual matches that are held in sumo wrestling and soared up the ranks from one to another until, in fact, in 1993, he reached the very top rank of all of being a yokozuna, or grand champion. He was the first foreign-born person to do so in Japan. But the impact he had on Japanese culture was quite profound because once this foreigner had first broken the glass ceiling and become a grand champion, many more foreigners tried to do the same and in fact did do the same. and this caused quite a panic in Japan, when suddenly people thought, goodness me, are we not producing any champions of our own? What is happening? So the solution that the elders found was to restrict the number of foreigners to one per stable, so that Japanese had more chance of producing the grand champion. And so it has really remained ever since, the Japanese trying to keep a pretty firm hold on it, for after all, it is their national sport and it's a Shinto ritual as well as a sport. So it's culturally very important that they keep tabs on it. But Akebono was not thoroughly satisfied with the way sumo was going, and he was aware, as everyone was, that the number of recruits and the number of fans were both steadily falling. Sumo just seems such a hidebound and ritualistic sport now, and not exactly audience-friendly. You have a lot of build-up, and then in a few seconds, it's all over. So he wanted himself to change the rules if he could, and to make it open, certainly, so that anyone could come and learn it. But when he asked the elders if, from his position as grand champion, he could come and advise, they said no very firmly. They were certainly not going to give way on the fundamental rules. So at that point, Akebono felt that he had nothing more to gain from being a sumo wrestler, and he decided to retire from it. But on the day that he actually retired from being a yokozuna in 1993, he sat in his robes on a throne in front of 11,000 people, and 320 of his friends and colleagues came and snipped a few strands of his hair to show that he was laying down the career of a sumo wrestler. He felt very sad about this, sadder than he thought he would, and his head felt lighter, not so much from the loss of his hair as from the loss of the honour of being a sumo grand champion and of the responsibility of having brought two nations together.
Anne Rowe on Akebono, who has died aged 54. That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. The show's editors are Chris Impey and Jat Gill. Our deputy editor is Jonjo Devlin, and our sound engineer is Will Rowe, with help this week from Johnny Allen. Our senior producers are Rory Galloway and Sarah Larniuk. Our senior creative producer is William Warren. Our producers are Maggie Kadifa and Benji Guy, and our assistant producer is Henrietta McFarlane, with extra production help this week from Jonathan Day. We'll all see you back here tomorrow for the weekend edition of The Intelligence.
World peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world, and in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.